Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're asking the question, should you be buying or renting in an insane housing market?
That is right, buddy. We are talking all about housing during this episode specifically because, like you mentioned, it is insane right now. Prices are sky high, and we're going to talk a lot about that during this episode. But first, I wanted to share with you something crazy that I was able to witness firsthand at our local hardware store.
Okay. All right.
And it's crazy because it almost happened to me. It wasn't something I witnessed. It's something I think I almost experienced firsthand.
I guess a shovel to the face.
Why do you always choose violence?
I don't know. It would have been a good story.
No shovel to the face, no rake to the face. I didn't step on anything. I was there picking up some supplies for a little project I was doing, and a lady approached me, and she said that she had a $180 gift card, Lowe's gift card, and that she needed $100 cash to pay to get the boot taken off her car out in the parking lot. And I was like, wait, what? You know, once I got her story, I was trying to figure out what was going on. And then I realized, well, it doesn't really matter because I don't have $100 on me. She was looking for $100 cash. And she's like, okay, no problem. And she explained it to me too when she was asking if I had $100 because she said, hey, I will check out with you and you can use the card to pay for whatever you need to buy as long as it's less than $180 and you'll see the remaining balance on there. You get the card and then you just give me $100 cash. There's no risk. That's what she said. And so later on when I was checking out, she was with another guy in the checkout line. I was like, oh man, there's a dude. He had $100. Yeah. And so in my mind, I was thinking, you know what? This is a great case to always have $100 cash on your person.
Just in case.
To be able to take advantage of something like this, right? And so I was like, good for him. He checked out. He saw the receipt, printed out the remaining balance on the card. She gave him the card. I watched him give her $100. He left. She left. It looked like it was going to have a happy ending. And maybe it did. However, it was like later that evening, it's like I kept thinking through that, like something about that just stood out to me as, you know, not necessarily being perfectly on the up and up.
And you know what that probably was. Can I guess here?
Where's the flaw? Or
She's got the gift card number and she can use it online.
Exactly. She could immediately, so she could go home and do it herself, or she could instantly text somebody else and be like, pull the plug or whatever. And whether it's draining the funds out of that account, from that card, or going ahead and just purchasing whatever it is that they want to purchase because, like you said, it was an active card. She had the number. And even though the new guy, he had the physical card, he was walking out of the store. It could potentially be days or even weeks before he needs to make another purchase, by which time that money is going to be long gone.
That's right.
And it was like one of those instances where it just came to me. I'm sure I was in the shower, actually, like not thinking about it. And all of a sudden, it just like, the thought flooded into my mind. Oh, no, that guy just got scammed.
That's the way the
and
brain
I realized,
works.
And I put it together. I was just like, that is how you do it.
Yeah.
And so I share that because I want to make sure that if anybody encounters a situation like this, I mean, I'm not going to tell you not to do it because perhaps somebody that's truly the situation that they are in. I could definitely see it working out if you were buying at least
a minimum of $100.
A minimum of $100 worth of stuff. Exactly. But if you are counting on coming back and using that card in the future, then I think you might be sorry out of luck.
Well,
in his case, it looked like he only had maybe like $30 to $50 worth of stuff. I don't exactly know. But yeah, if you're only dropping like $10, I mean, if you're going to spend $120 and she's asking for $100, I think that could be a situation where, okay, like if everything lines up and I'm able to actually do this, there are no flaws.
Yeah.
There are no holes in this plan, but it definitely seems like that there's a chance for somebody to take advantage of somebody else.
Well, and sometimes criminals will do that with gift cards that are on the shelf. Like they will scratch off the stuff on the back and they will use those funds. You buy that gift card from the store and then
it gets activated.
There's nothing on it. Like, or they're immediately, once you activate, they're siphoning those funds. And so, there are a lot of potential scams with gift cards, not to mention just the fact that if you have a gift card, you probably have a ton of gift cards. Most of us have gift cards that are sitting in a drawer that have gone unused. There's so many flaws in the gift card system. And so avoiding them most of the time is probably a good idea for most of us. And especially in this case, yeah, I'm just kind of reticent when someone comes up to me like that anyway. But you're right. The only foolproof way to do it is to spend more than $100. And even, I don't know, it's kind of just like an awkward thing to go through as well.
Well, I mean, it's awkward, but I was willing to, you know, to talk with her and be like, okay, what's your situation? But before I realized, I was like, wait a minute, I don't have $100 in cash on me. I'm sorry. And she didn't have like Cash App or whatever. She was wanting $100 in cash. Maybe it would have been a better story if I had gotten scammed. if it had been me that had gotten taken advantage of, I guess it would have been maybe a more fun story to share. Maybe that guy is listening to the show and he's like, that was me. You should have said something. But now everybody knows. But Joel, let's share the beer that we're going to enjoy this episode. This is an El Cedro. This is a hoppy cedar aged ale by Jester King. Looking forward to sharing this one with you, and we will give our thoughts on this one at the end of the episode.
That's right. But for now, let's get on to the topic at hand. Let's talk about buying versus renting, especially in a market that is like super nutso. And Matt, as we were kind of thinking about this episode, it made me think about singing karaoke with friends, and which is just like a really fun pastime, I think.
It's been a minute. I haven't done karaoke in a few years.
I mean, I think part of that is probably COVID related. Like, who's going to been going to karaoke bars? I'm sure they've been
fewer folks
struggling. But to me, I think it's a lot of fun. And you know what? I want to get back at it. Let's go to a karaoke bar soon, right?
Let's do it.
And so it's one of my favorite things to do, especially with a good bunch of friends. Mm-hmm. And of course, the song I always choose to sing. You know what it is.
Hootie and the Blowfish song,
of course,
right?
Yes. It's Letter Cry by Hootie and the Blowfish. That is the song that I traditionally choose.
It's funny how we revert to the impactful albums from our teen years.
Yes. It's either Hootie or it's Third Eye Blind or it's Oasis. Like, those are the bands I pick because those were
Eve Six.
Yeah.
That was
like seventh grade for me.
There's a lot of songs from back in the day.
And they still hold sway.
My personal go-to is a song by Queen, but I'm not going to give away my secret weapon. you'll have to be there in person if you want to experience it.
Everybody's got their go-to when they're singing karaoke. And I personally, Matt, I like to sing it with a lot of enthusiasm. You know, I'm not a wallflower when I'm singing karaoke. I'm going all the way.
That's what it's all about, man.
Yeah, exactly. But let's say someone instead asked me to sing that same Hootie song in a stadium filled with strangers that I didn't know. Like before
like
a Braves game or
national
something.
National anthem style?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. I would freak out. Like, that sounds like the opposite of fun. Whereas like karaoke with a small group of friends sounds like a blast. And I will, you know, I would even sing like Let It Go like Elsa at the top of my lungs if I needed to. But in front of a crowd of people I don't know, that it's like the opposite effect. And basically what that reflects is the fact that the stakes just went up a good deal.
That's true.
And we would say the same thing is true with the housing market. When we're talking about buying versus renting, as we've seen what's happened in the housing market over the past year in particular, it's well documented that home prices have soared, that rents are soaring right now too. And so, you know, we're going to weigh in on this episode with thoughts about how you should proceed if you're not sure whether you should keep renting or whether you should be taking the plunge into home ownership.
Yeah, that's right. And we've got some data to back up that nutso claim that you just made on the rising prices of homes. The average price of a home rose $50,000 over the past 12 months. And so what that means is that if you bought a house last year, you're probably doing a fist pump in the air right now. You probably have seen that number reflected in your Zestimate. If you didn't, though, and you want to, you're probably feeling a bit dejected. And you might be wondering, too, whether the housing market is in a bubble that's going to pop soon. Well, fact is, we don't think that is going to be the case. The demographics and the fundamentals are really strong right now. Home buyers are coming in with a lot of cash to put down. Their credit scores are great. This isn't a scenario like in 2008 where, you know, or prior to 2008, I guess I should say, where unqualified buyers were getting big loans that they couldn't afford. And then add to that the fact that inventory is at all-time lows. There just aren't enough houses out there for all the people that want to own one. And so, you know, we said it before, we still believe it. We don't think that the typical home is going to decrease in value. And so, yeah, whether you're looking to buy or you just want to rent, prices are higher than ever.
That's right, yeah. The stakes are higher, prices are higher, and I think it's causing maybe some more emotion to be thrust into all of our personal decisions when it comes to buying versus renting.
There's more money on the line.
Exactly, yep. And so, although housing prices won't increase as rapidly moving forward, that's got to be the case, right? Like, I don't think they can continue at roughly a 20% increase on average over a sustained period of time. We're still not going to see housing prices correct in a meaningful way in the near future, though. And there are so many reasons that prices are where they are today. Insanely low interest rates are one of those things that helped fuel even higher prices. not enough home builders in the aftermath of the housing crash. A lot of those builders went bankrupt or just, you know, their businesses shrunk a great deal. And so we have a shortage of homes in this country. Also, we have this largely millennial cohort who now wants to buy. All of those things are impacting the market in a substantial way, constraining the supply and causing prices to shoot up at faster rates. And now inflation and higher interest rates are adding insult to injury for anyone who wants to buy a home but hasn't pulled the trigger yet. And so, yeah, as interest rates are starting to quickly tick up, that means that affordability is becoming even more of a conundrum for a whole lot of people when they're making this decision.
Yeah, I liked how you mentioned just the millennial generation because, I mean, bottom line, I mean, I don't know if like a lot of folks may not know this, but like the millennials are a larger cohort than Gen Xers.
That's right.
And so what we're seeing is that we've got baby boomers who are sticking around longer. They're healthier. They're living longer. They're staying in their homes. And then you've got the generation ahead of us, Gen Xers. They're fairly established when it comes to homeownership and the homes that they want to own. And then you've got the millennial generation who is coming of homeownership age, and they're looking for a bunch of houses that don't exist.
Yeah, and millennials were a little bit delayed when it came to pursuing homeownership.
Took us a little bit longer to grow up.
Yeah, a little bit later than most generations, but I think now we're like a lot of millennials are like, okay, I'm ready to pounce, like ready to do this adulting thing and buy a home. And now it feels like, where are the homes at? Like they disappeared.
Exactly. Well, so you were just mentioning interest rates though as well and how with them going up, that might have an impact on affordability. You know, like simultaneously, those higher interest rates, like they might be just what mellows out the rising prices this year. That is yet to be determined because this would be a good thing, right? Considering how things have gotten out of control recently, that combination of low supply, high demand, historically low rates, all those things together is largely what got us to this point. But even still, if rates go up, that doesn't necessarily make the house that you want more affordable. Because even if it does chill demand some, like we're still likely going to see the prices continue to rise. And then, of course, the rising value of owner-occupied properties, like that means that rents are on the rise as well. Higher sale prices lead to higher assessed values of rental properties, which means landlords are having to charge more just to keep up with their ongoing tax bills.
Yeah, and let's talk about rent prices for a second, Matt, because that has been an interesting phenomenon too. And it's in particular over the last couple of years, because for a little while during the pandemic, rents were actually falling, if you remember. And people were able to sign another lease at actually a lower rate than what they'd had the previous year.
Down is up, up is down.
Yeah, especially—
cars are worth more this year than they were last year, your
I know.
Used car.
and especially in certain
it's been
cities
a weird time.
Like New York and San Francisco, where a lot of people just left the city for a good period of time, those cities saw even more dramatic decreases in rent prices. But that didn't really last all that long in the grand scheme of things. And now there are actually fewer vacant apartments than ever before when you look at the statistics. So we're literally at all-time highs for occupancy rates. And due to the basic concept of supply and demand, that therefore means that rents are rising quickly. So
yep.
So it's the higher taxes that some landlords are having to pay based on rising prices. But then it's also the fact that like they don't have any other
good
places.
Good luck finding a place.
Yeah, exactly. And so they're able to charge a whole lot more than they were able to just 12 months ago. And so by the end of 2021, average rents for a two-bedroom apartment were up nearly 17%. And average rents were up more than 21% for a one-bedroom. A lot of cities saw that increase by 50%.
Yeah, some cities. It's crazy. It's just funny how it's like, you want a one-bedroom apartment by yourself? You want to be by yourself and not have to have roommates? It's going to cost you more.
Yeah.
We're really going to stick it to you,
right? And so there's
all you introverts out there.
There's just this massive quick rebound, and it means if your lease has come up for renewal in the past 12 months, you are probably shocked at the offer you got from your landlord. And so, yeah, we have to kind of take that into consideration as we're talking about this renting versus buying. Well, you know, renting is getting a whole lot more expensive for everyone too. So it does kind of feel like you're between a rock and a hard place when you're making this decision.
Yeah, so what does this all tell us? Because the state of the housing market, it seems to be quite frothy right now, even though we just explained earlier how it appears that the fundamentals are solid. But that being said, we haven't quite seen anything like this before. How it is that you approach the riddle of buying versus renting, it needs to come with some nuance and some thoughtfulness. Some out there are feeling FOMO while simultaneously seeing how much they owe in rent increasing substantially. And so we're going to do our best to help you to think through the most important trade-offs. And we're going to get to all of that right after this break.
All right, we're back. We're talking about buying versus renting in what is an insane housing market right now. And Matt, I think we should start off this part of the show, this segment, by maybe challenging some of the conventional wisdom out there, because
I thought you were going to bring us back with like a ludicrous headline of the week.
I was going to bring it back with a rake to the face, but I don't have one on me. So, but the traditional approach when it comes to homeownership, I mean, I feel like the conventional wisdom has been that buying a home makes sense for everyone.
Right.
And that's kind of, there's like a cult of home ownership in our country that's been pushed on people generation after generation. And so it's almost been assumed that owning a home is this surefire path for middle-class folks to build wealth. And so you should participate in this sector of our economy. And you're almost seen as...
Be a good citizen, Joel.
Right, yeah.
Buy a home.
It's your patriotic duty to buy a home, right? And you're almost seen as kooky or fringe if you didn't subscribe to this belief. People were like, what's your deal? Like, why don't you love America? It's kind of... I feel like the way people viewed you if you questioned the belief that home ownership was a silver bullet for everyone. And... like I say, it was more than a belief, even. It was kind of almost a religion of sorts. And because of that, so many people just drank the Kool-Aid of home ownership. But millennials kind of weren't having it, at least for a period of time. And it is that pendulum that swung in the other direction, at least for a while, right? Where millennials were waiting longer and longer to buy a home. And maybe it looked like, a lot of people were predicting, maybe they are going to break this trend of of home ownership being kind of central to the American way of life.
They're like, I'm not buying a home.
Right.
I'm going to put my dollars towards experiences, travel, things like that.
And we saw people, you know, settling in cities more and more, but we're starting to see some of those trends go back to normal. And even those people are saying now it's time to buy a home. And of course, like you said, that is one of the reasons that we're seeing the trend that we're currently seeing of just like not enough homes, too many buyers, and prices going through the roof.
That's right. But as we're talking about this from an investment standpoint, here's the thing we want to make sure that we're sharing here. Buying isn't necessarily a great investment, because like anyone who's bought a home in the past few years, like they definitely feel like it was a great investment.
Well, and for them, it's had good returns.
Yes, it's definitely provided that for them. But like that doesn't mean that buying a house is always going to be a great investment, because, you know, that home provides a whole lot of things. For, you know, number one, first of all, being a roof over our heads, it also allows you to put down roots in a specific community. But those things come with a cost. And when most of us are assessing how well we've done with our quote-unquote investment in that home, like we tend to only think about the increase in value. We don't think about the money that we're constantly having to sink into the house, whether we have to because it's a repair or because we want to just to make it a little bit nicer.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like if you were only paying attention to the revenue portion of a profit and loss statement and you're ignoring the expenses. It's just like, oh, man, look how much we grossed. Holy cow, so much money. But it's like, oh, no, there's a cost.
But you also had to meet payroll and pay for the snacks in the break room. And like, there's all of these, and buy computers for the staff. Like,
exactly.
There are all of these other things. And you're right. Like, those are the things that most of us aren't considering when we're thinking about how much, whether it's been a good investment or not for us. We usually look at our primary house through rosy-colored glasses, even though when we're looking at just the hard numbers, it's not really all that rosy from an investment standpoint.
Yeah, and oftentimes because we're not treating our primary residences as, we're not treating it like a business. And well, actually, I think we'll talk a little bit more about that later on.
That's right. Yeah, we don't necessarily think you need to, but that is kind of at the crux of why buying a home is not always a great investment. And so, yeah, we're going to give a framework here of things to think through when deciding whether renting or buying makes sense for you. And basically, it's a matrix of decision making, because there's no simple right answer. It's not necessarily yes or no. There are too many factors, too many personal factors, to hastily jump into an easy recommendation. Like, Matt, if we were on the phone with our listener right now and they were asking a bunch of questions, like we would have a lot of things for them to think through before we gave our advice on which one we thought was better for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy decision for anyone. And of course, since you know you're listening to How to Money, like we'll start with personal finances and your specific money situation. Do you have any money saved for a down payment? Would be probably the first question we would ask you. And if the answer is no, then we don't think you should be buying a home. And you don't necessarily have to have 20% or more to put down, although that's ideal in our estimation.
I like for you to put down 20% all the time, but we also know that there's going to be some situations where there are other priorities that rise to the surface.
Exactly. And so that is a great thing to shoot for, and that's ideal from a personal finance perspective, but it's not something that everyone can do all the time. And yeah, but still, you have to have done a reasonable job saving up for this big purchase. If you're like, I've got $1,200 in the bank, can I buy a house? The answer is no. Like, the answer is you're not ready.
Probably not going to work out for you.
Exactly.
Especially in today's market.
That won't even cover the closing costs. But yeah, not having any skin in the game when you buy a home, we would say is a recipe for financial difficulties, potentially financial disaster, especially with a purchase that's as big as a home.
That's right. Yeah. So one of the advantages to owning a home is that it's a forced method of savings. And unfortunately, it's the only form of investing that a lot of folks are doing. This is evidenced by the fact that the bottom 90% of Americans have the overwhelming majority of their wealth tied to their housing. But here's the thing. Your primary house, it should not be your biggest investment. Like, I don't mean that you shouldn't love your home, but you should have more money in retirement accounts than in primary home equity. And as long as you are investing regularly in your retirement accounts, from a wealth building standpoint, like, there's no real necessity to actually own a home. So much of the decision should come down to other factors instead of just the desire to start, you know, quote unquote, building equity.
Yeah, I like what you said there, Matt, that it's not a necessity. Right. And I think sometimes people assume that maybe that's part of the Kool-Aid that we've drunk, is that home ownership is a necessity to wealth building. And no, it's not. And actually, in many times, it's a hindrance to people when it comes to building their wealth. Obviously, we've been in a cycle that is abnormal over the past, like, 18 to 24 months when it comes to home price increases. And really, we've seen outsized gains in home prices ever since, like, as the end of that Great Recession, as home prices were recovering since, what, the bottom of the market in 2010, home prices have appreciated substantially. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take that most recent data and extrapolate it and say that buying a home makes sense for everyone at all times, mm-hmm. because it doesn't. And yeah, another similar consideration is the fact that your mortgage is fixed. And we like to recommend fixed rate mortgages because over time, that mortgage begins to look better and better.
Yeah.
As rents are going up around you, your mortgage only goes up based on the amount you pay in insurance and taxes. And so let's say your mortgage day one is $1,400 a month. Well, 3 years down the line, your mortgage is probably going to be like $1,482, because just the taxes and insurance are the only things that are moving the needle on what you're paying. And so, yeah, it has nothing to do with interest rates or what's happening with inflation. You're basically insulated from rising prices, and that mortgaged home with a fixed rate becomes this hedge against inflation too. And so that is definitely one thing to consider. It can be helpful from that standpoint, where especially now people are feeling their rents getting jacked up. And someone who has a fixed rate mortgage on a primary home is sitting pretty from at least that standpoint.
Yeah, and not only hedge, but I mean, it almost at times, I'm sure, feels like a deflationary debt, right? Because it continues to stay the same while everything else goes up in price. It almost feels like it's getting more affordable to live in the house.
Oh, especially right now.
That you're staying in. Don't let that reality get you to buy more house than you should. And that's because you don't want to be house poor. That, if you were to put yourself in that position, is going to be really stressful. If that monthly payment is now at the top tier of what you can afford, it's better to either just save up for longer. That way you've got more money to put down so your monthly payment is slightly less, or buy less house so that you are able to feel a little more comfortable with your budget every single month.
Yeah. And Matt, what people aren't taking into consideration when they buy a house that's either at the top of their budget or almost exceeds their budget, it feels unaffordable, but it's the home of their dreams, is what happens if your circumstances change? What happens if your job no longer needs your services? And our family found ourselves in that exact circumstance when I was a kid, where my dad, someone had given him the advice of buying a home kind of at the top of his price range, because of course, dude, you're in line for a promotion, and pretty soon that's going to look like a drop in the bucket in your budget as you move up the ranks in this company. And so he was like, okay, I'll do it. But soon after, his company got bought out by another company, and he was no longer employed there. And so it was one of those things where now he already has a house that's essentially at the top of the budget, and now the budget's completely blown out of the water. And that happens to people every day, mm-hmm. where their job circumstance changes in a negative way, where the economy experiences a downturn, and that creates an economic downturn in their family finances. And that makes it so much harder than to afford that mortgage. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, it's important to be careful and to bite off less than you can chew And that's particularly true, I think, when we're talking about houses.
That's right. Yeah, you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you are counting on everything going exactly as planned. Your timeline, Joel, that's something else we want to share with folks too, because that's one of the most important considerations. If you only plan to stay in that home for like a mere 18 months, there's a massive likelihood that you'll be underwater when you go to sell. This is, of course, assuming that home prices don't continue to climb at that 20% every single year.
Right, which is unlikely.
but bottom line, there's volatility in all markets. Definitely you see that when it comes to investing in the stock market, but even when it comes to the housing market as well. And so anytime you're able to stretch out your timeline, that mitigates risk and it reduces your exposure to that volatility. Another reason why your time frame is so important too is because of the transaction costs involved with buying and selling. And again, you know, the same might be true of your index funds within the market, but at least there, you know, there's none of the friction involved that takes a chunk off the top.
Right.
Closing costs, realtor fees, they will eat you alive in this scenario. And so that's why we always recommend a minimum ownership timeline of 5 years. If you were to stay even longer than that, like 7 to 10 years, that would be even better.
Yeah.
You want to be able to spread some of these expenses and these costs over a longer period of time.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of like a made-up example. Let's say every apple you purchased cost $1 a pound, but on top of it, you had to pay $1 every time you purchased any quantity of apples. So you probably wouldn't buy one apple at a time. You would probably buy a whole bunch of apples and then try to eat them throughout that week,
a
right?
A whole peck of them. Is that the right term?
That might be too many. I don't know how much
peck of apples.
I think it is the right term, but I'm not.
A bushel?
Is a bushel more than a peck?
I don't know, man.
I think it is.
I don't know all these agrarian terms. I'm kind of rusty in my Wendelberry.
Well, I think the same is true kind of for real estate, right? It's that concept of all those transaction costs make it prohibitive to buy and sell. They almost kind of they gum up the gears. And it's going to cost you a whole lot of money if you don't hold on to that long enough. And you don't necessarily need to live in it for all those years, as long as you're comfortable and that house is actually going to make sense as a rental property.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're holding on to it and not selling it, then those costs aren't going to eat you alive in the same way. But those things have to be taken into consideration because they represent a substantial cost to you as someone buying a home.
That is right. But even still, it's more than just these monetary and time frame considerations that you need to examine before you make a decision. There are other factors. Specifically, there are some different lifestyle factors that you need to keep in mind. And so we will discuss those considerations right after this break.
All right, we're back. And of course, Matt, we had to cover all the nerdy financial stuff. And
of course.
You have to take those things into consideration.
We're going
to
lead with the dollars and cents.
Yes, exactly.
And we'll get to the... It's like, this is like more the fun stuff. Like the other... This is like the dream... Like when you're dreaming about buying a new home or whether you should rent or buy, I mean, most people probably aren't thinking about like what is... How is this going to affect my bottom line? They're thinking about all the different ways that it's going to be fun, right? Like actual dreaming.
Good for their family or the ways they want to decorate or the ways they plan to like integrate their lives into the community around them.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of things you're thinking about when you're buying a home. But we're here to tell you, you have to think about those other things. You have to think about saving and you have to think about the transaction costs and how long you're actually going to stay there because those are massively influential into making a wise decision.
That's like your vegetables and your meat. Like you want to make sure that you get those important things first, and then it's like, okay, now let's talk about the starchy sides. Let's talk about the bread, the noodles, maybe a little bit of fruit, some dessert. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, and I think actually some of these lifestyle decisions are actually more impactful than just the dessert part of your meal, because you have
that's
to,
true.
Yeah, you do have to think about.
We'll stop it at fruit. You don't want to get scurvy,
right? Exactly. So yeah, you have to think about what you want your life to look like, and that will impact how long you plan on staying in that house, mm-hmm. right? If it's a house in a community you feel like you can set roots down in for a long time, then and it's not just like a fly by night emotional purchase, then that bears weight in the decision. And so yeah, these are the kind of crucial questions you need to ask before you dive in head first. You don't want to think too much about your return on investment when you're choosing to live in the city or the country, because some things come down to personal preference. And you're not necessarily saying, well, the prices in the city, those home prices are going to they're going to net me more money over the next 10 years. If you don't want to be a city dweller, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, some folks are just more happy to be renters their entire lives, too. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a personal choice. And we want you to take that to heart. Like, we don't want you to do something just because of the financials, we want you to take strong consideration into what you want your life to look like, because that's massively important. And that's why we try to take a balanced view towards this topic. We want you to build wealth and reach financial independence, whether you decide to buy a home or not. And we think it's extremely possible whether you decide to buy a home or not.
That's true. Yeah. So it kind of makes me think about, like, if you're dating, right? If you're dating and you're trying to find somebody that you want to spend the rest of your life with, well, it's important to know if she is a doctor and she's going to make bank over over the next, you know, rest of her lifetime, whatever. Or if you're dating a guy and he has like $200,000 in student loans. Like, these are things that are worth knowing, but you don't make the decision because of those things.
Right.
You should be making, I guess you could, but that feels a little, I don't know, it feels a little skeezy. It feels a little dirty if that is what is directing your, you know, you choosing to date somebody.
I believe you're then called a gold digger, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, maybe the dating relationship isn't as accurate as, like, if you're considering changing your career. That feels a little less permanent. Folks change their jobs, they change their careers fairly often. And as you're considering a career change, it is worth thinking through your salary, what you're going to be making. But if that is all that you're basing your decision on, there's a good chance you might be making good money, but you're miserable going to work day after day because it's not something that truly resonates with your soul. You don't see how you're actually making a positive impact on the world. You don't see how you're able to serve other people or make their lives better. You've just found an industry where you are able to make a ton of money. That is not the only consideration that you have to keep in mind. And so I think it's similar with housing. We have to consider some of the other implications. We can't just look at the bottom line.
Yeah, I completely agree. There are a lot of factors that go beyond just money. And even those lifestyle factors influence our finances. And mm-hmm. So let's talk about renting for a second, Matt, because renting has some real perks. And it's important to note the benefits of renting, because I think sometimes there's another common misnomer that renting is throwing away money.
It gets the shaft.
Yep. And so people just automatically dismiss it. And they say, if you want to live a sound financial life, then you shouldn't be renting. That's a move for dummies. But that is not true. And so let's mention some of those perks. One, you don't have to fix anything. That is a huge perk, especially if you are like super into your career and you are moving up the ladder and you are making good money and you prioritize that. I think home ownership has not side hustle type hours, but it does involve maintenance and it demands a certain amount of your attention.
Yeah, it's got like this baseline responsibility associated with it.
Yep, but if you're renting, not so much.
You can just peace out.
Just call the landlord when the water heater goes out or if there's a leak in the roof. Those are the headaches that you don't have to worry about. And so, yeah, you might not have the capacity to deal with the mm-hmm. issues that arise with home ownership. And that is a great reason to rent. And generally speaking, renting gives you more options too. Like, it's more flexible. And so, yeah, it's short term. You can always pick up and move closer to family or friends if you want to. Or, yeah, if into something larger or smaller if you get a big dog or if your kids go off to college. One specific house doesn't necessarily meet your needs on a 30-year timeline, which is usually how long you're taking out a mortgage. And so it might make sense to rent instead and then shift as your life shifts and shift as your job shifts. Like, there's no reason that people should necessarily buy a home. And in fact, renting can be a better move lifestyle-wise for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and you know, we already talked about financial considerations and how, like, you need to have a chunk of money for a down payment. But in many parts of the country, renting is going to be cheaper than owning on a monthly basis, not just upfront. In fact, there is a LendingTree study, and they found that on average, renters paid $606 less than homeowners with a mortgage each month on housing costs, which also included utilities, taxes, fees. Although, that being said, I'm going to point to another report too, because this one is slightly more recent, and it found that it's actually cheaper to own than rent in 58% of the country. And so what you're hearing is conflicting information come out of my mouth. But the bottom line is that these numbers vary significantly from city to city. So much depends on where it is that you live. And so you've got to take all that into account. And luckily, there are calculators that can help you with your specific location. We will make sure to link to those different calculators in our show notes for this episode.
Yeah, real estate is local. And so you can't just extrapolate because, for instance, we talked about average home price increase over the past 12 months has been something like 17-18%. But if you're living in Idaho, it's been a heck of a lot more than that. And then there are other parts of the country where you have seen less significant growth. And so much of that depends on the trends that are happening in the country, where people are moving to. And real estate is local. You got to make sure to take that into account. And renting is almost always the best course of action, Matt, we would say, when somebody moves to a new city.
Right.
And so, yeah, if you're someone who likes to move around a lot, renting is clearly the way to go, in our opinion. But even if you're certain you're going to stick around in a new city, you got a new job and you're like, this is the job, this is my dream job, I'm going to be there for 10 plus years. Well, it's still best to rent for that first year so you get the lay of the land and you kind of find what neighborhoods you gravitate towards, which places you end up hanging out the most, where your friend group is largely based. And so, yeah, we would say find that out before you make this knee-jerk decision to buy a house, because it's a permanent decision, and largely because of those transaction costs we discussed earlier, it's important to get it right the first time. And if you end up buying in a part of town and you're like, oh, this is just not ideal, and the traffic actually really stinks on the way home, and I wish I lived a little bit closer, or I wish I lived in this more rural spot that actually fits better for like what I like to do on the weekends. That's why renting, I think, can be so powerful when you're first moving to a place. So you're not just basing it on blog posts and internet and stuff you're reading on the internet. Like there's that real life experience you want to gather.
That's true. But on the other side of the coin, right? Like we've got the buying side here. And if you find the place that you want to be for years on end, like you're getting something intangible, but also very important if you end up purchasing. There's that level of security that comes with a home purchase because you can't be forced to move just because your landlord says it's time to sell. You have the ability to use whatever color paint you want on the walls. This is your place. You get to customize it. You get to make the little modifications that your landlord never let you add on back when you were renting.
You can do as much like floral print wallpaper as you want, like to your heart's content.
Wallpaper's expensive, man.
Like we found that out recently. Emily really wanted to put wallpaper, literally just
wallpaper's back, you know,
just in the half bath. And we looked up the prices and we're like, we're just going to paint.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, bucket of paint is way more affordable.
It's crazy.
Yeah, and like it takes a special application process. Like you need somebody that knows how to put wallpaper up properly.
That's right.
And those folks are fewer and far between. So we're talking about buying, but like, when you buy, you are also putting down roots in a community, which adds this level of richness to a living situation. This is, I guess, what I was saying, like those different intangibles. You can't really put a numerical value on the depth of relationship that comes when you are living somewhere because you have purchased there. Yeah. You approach everything differently when there's a busted water main, or you know, like you know, we live in an old part of town.
Like, this is my street, and I'm gonna make sure that gets taken care of.
You see, like a little trickle of water coming up through the asphalt, and you know, I think for the most part, most renters would see that and be like, not my problem.
Well, I do.
Whereas owners see it and they think, oh man, like we got to get that taken care of. This is gonna wreck the street.
I do want to speak to that because I think you're right in many respects. But I also think that there are some renters who feel that sense of community. And some of them feel like, I remember one neighbor just a few years ago as his rent was going up, he felt like he basically had to move budget-wise somewhere else. And he was a stakeholder in our community and I hated to see him go for that reason.
It's a bummer.
And so there are some people who rent who feel that passionately about their community.
You definitely, yeah.
And so, yeah.
But I think oftentimes it can be harder. And there's sort of like this like you can't put your finger on it. But like if you know in the back of your mind that you're not here forever, if it feels even less permanent, there's always that call of potentially going somewhere else.
That's right. Yeah. So Matt, let's talk about maybe somebody who says, okay, listen, I hear what you guys are saying, but I want to be a buyer. That's still a goal of mine. And I get that. I think it's a reasonable goal to have. And a lot of people do want to own a home. And that is something that you and I, we both own our own home, and it has been, for the most part, a good thing for us and for our families. And we have felt those intangible benefits that you just talked about, a sense of community, a sense of belonging. And we love the community where we live. And so, yeah, what do you do if you want to own a home, but you're just not ready financially? I think that's an important question for us to answer. And I think our initial answer would be to save more money. Like, really start saving now.
Save.
Yes, make that an actual priority and start funneling your dollars into a savings account so that you can be ready to purchase in the near future. And you know, set a goal, make a timeline so that you can actually reach that goal in a specific amount of time, whether it's 24 months, 36 months, 48 months. And you know, one other thing I would say is saving is really important. But if you have a longer timeline before you're planning to buy or before you think you'll be able to buy, investing some or even all of those down payment dollars can make a lot of sense for people too. And so, yeah, you'll likely want to be more conservative than you normally would be with dollars that you're investing for retirement inside of your 401k, because that's decades down the road, and this is just years down the road. But yeah,
you want to buy a house in a few years, not in a few decades.
Exactly. I mean, maybe you know that's how far off you want to push home ownership, but that's not the case for most people. And so a target date fund is that's in the near future is often a good choice, like a target date fund 2025 or 2030. There's also an ETF called HOM that was specifically created to help people save for a down payment, and it's more weighted towards bonds, but it also has some stock exposure, including more stocks in the real estate sector. And so it is supposed to kind of mirror what's happening in the housing market to a certain extent. And so I think either of those places would be a good place for you to put those down payment dollars if you're in this camp where it's going to be in that 4 to 6 year timeline, maybe, before you buy a house. If it's in that next like year to 18 months, you probably don't want to be investing, putting almost any of it at risk in the stock market.
That's right. And while we're talking about investing, there might be a lot of folks out there who are saying to themselves, like, Joel and Matt, like, don't you own rental properties? It's, you know, it seems like that you are both all in on real estate. You guys own like what, 4 or 6 homes each? And that is true. But there is a massive difference between how most people think of their primary home and how real estate investors think of the homes that they purchase. Because when you buy a primary home, you're not necessarily thinking about the return on investment of the different improvements that you're planning to make. You're not assessing your personal residence based on investment metrics. And that is okay, like we've talked about here on the show. You don't necessarily need to do that. But that is 100% the different considerations that you take into account when you're buying an investment property. That's what allows rental properties to be really successful ventures if you do it right. There's this massive difference in mentality when you're buying a home for yourself and when you buy one as an investment, which, you know, can lead to very different outcomes.
Yeah. For instance, the price point that you're buying a home at. Let's say you're buying a home in the $650,000 range. That in all likelihood is not going to make a great investment property. Typically, the amount of rent does not go up in tandem with the home sale price. And so you're probably going to, if you want to find a good investment property, find something that's in the $250,000, maybe $300,000 range. That might be more appropriate. But if you buy a $750,000 house and you're like, this is going to be a good rental property someday, it's probably not going to make you very much money. And so those are things that real estate investors have to consider, but that homeowners don't necessarily have to consider.
That's right.
And yeah, one other thing, Matt, I would say is it's really easy, especially right now, to succumb to recency bias. You see that, like, this one particular phrase on every fund prospectus you read if you're an investor: past performance is not indicative of future returns. And that is true of home prices too. Like, could home prices in your area continue to soar? Could they continue to go up at a ridiculous clip? And sure, yeah, they can. Will they continue to increase at double-digit pace for years to come? The answer is probably not. That's highly unlikely. And so don't let the massive uptick in prices cause you to make a rushed decision that isn't right for your specific situation. Don't let what's happened in the last 18 to 24 months create FOMO in your brain, create FOMO in your house, saying we got to get in now before the housing market completely runs away from us. I'll admit, it's been a crazy last 24 months, and I can see how it'd be deflating, but I would not let that inform your decision making if your underlying financial fundamentals aren't solid and you're not actually ready to buy a house.
Totally agree, man. Yeah, there are going to be different strokes for different folks. There is not going to be a one-size-fits-all guidance rule of thumb, you know, for these types of nuanced decisions like this. Being a homeowner, it's going to be great if you want to be one and if you've taken the proper financial steps, like you mentioned. But being a renter is a completely fine decision as well. And in some markets, it's a much better choice when you're looking at the financials of it. And so no matter which route you take, we want to see our listeners. We want to see all of you How to Money listeners out there, all you besties, striving for financial independence. That doesn't have to include owning your own home, despite the popular belief that it must include home ownership.
Yeah, it's super tricky, Matt, because buying a home is such an emotional decision. Where we live, we spend so much time in that house, in our community, and I totally get it. Like,
yeah,
where I live,
it's a big deal.
I'm deeply attached to my neighborhood, but also to like my physical house. Like I love that thing. And I told people in the audience like that we have been renovating. We just moved back in. It's so exciting to be back in our house that we love. And it's it's this 1920s bungalow that has like all like unpainted molding. It's got all these original features that we're just kind of obsessed with. And being back inside it is just, it's really special for us.
I was going to say, is it magical? Is it like Encanto?
Which everybody's doing Encanto dance parties.
Dude, Lin-Manuel, he knows the formula. He knows how to write a catchy song that you cannot escape.
Yes, I'll say that. That's true. So yeah, I just don't want to downplay the role that emotions play in these decisions. But at the same time, you have to kind of find a way.
You have to rein them in. You have to keep them in check.
Yep. And it's not that they shouldn't play a part in your decision making, but don't let them take over and make the decision for you.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's get back to the beer that we had on this episode, Matt. This is El Cedro, and it is a beer.
Oh, speaking of Encanto.
my brother-in-law is a Spanish teacher, so I know how to talk like that.
The cedar, I guess, is what that means.
What was your take on this beer, Matt?
If we were still doing the one-word descriptions, I would say delightful. It's definitely got that hoppy farmhouse funk going on, right? Like you can totally taste what I presume is Brett, like Brettomyces, like that bacterial strain that they introduced to the beer. It gives it a very distinct flavor. It's got that going on, but I guess it's also got some of like the floral aromatics that you might get from cedar. We specifically picked this one up because it said cedar on it, and that is not something I have ever seen on a beer before. Have you ever had a beer with this type of wood in it?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, I mean, neither. I feel like it impacted the beer minimally, right? Like some beers we get that when they're aged in, you know, like puncheons or like new white oak wine barrels or something like that, you can really taste the effect of the wood on the beer. But with this, I feel like maybe it's just even more in the nose. It's more like in the florals and the aromatics. It's really subtle, but because of that, it makes it delightful.
Yeah, I wrote down three things. I wrote hoppy, earthy, and mineral-like. And yeah, it has some of those like mineral flavors going on.
Tastes like we're like taking a vitamin. This is like a vitamin beer over here, yeah. Like vitamin water.
Which just made me think,
without
like
the sugar.
This tastes like a beer the way they used to make beer back in the day. They kind of like a French table beer from the like early 1800s or something.
Or like they used to do back in Texas, which is where Jester King is located.
Right, which we still have not made it out to, sadly. Last time we made it to Austin, we had plans to get out to Jester King and we missed it.
They're so far out from the city.
Well, because they're on like a farmhouse setting, apparently.
Which is cool. Yeah. Like, it's great that they're out in the desert, but at the same time, it makes it, I mean, I can't take a bird scooter to Jester King.
That's true. Well, next time we'll, I don't know, rent a car.
Make it a priority.
We'll get out there.
For sure.
Yes. But yeah, I'm glad we got to share this one together on this episode. And that's going to do it for this episode. For listeners who want show notes, links to anything we mentioned on today's show, we'll have those up in the show notes on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.